The second investigator duo I met with was Dr. Tom Lynch and Dr. Jyothi Patel. To begin, Dr. Grabowski posed a question and a case that generated the question.
The question that I have in practice, not infrequently, is two-pronged. Number one, what, if any, instance there is of synchronous mutations? And secondly, is there ever a change in the mutation status of a tumor? And is there ever a reason to retest for mutations? And the specific case that brought this to the forefront is I have a woman in mid-60s who underwent a retroperitoneal lobectomy for a stage 2A adenocarcinoma approximately 2 years ago. At that time, her tumor was tested and tested positive for KRAS mutation and was negative for EGFR mutation. At that time, this was prior to us doing routine testing for EML4-ALK.
She was a non-smoker?
She was a former smoker. Had smoked approximately a pack a day for 30 years, but had quit 20 years earlier. 2 years later, she's now presented with a recurrence in a peribronchial lymph node, which has been confirmed with endobronchial ultrasound guided fineal aspiration.
Jyothi?
Did she get adjuvant chemotherapy?
Yes, I'm sorry. She received postoperative adjuvant pemetrexed and cisplatin for 4 cycles. So now it's approximately 2 years later, and she looks like she has a local regional recurrence. So the real issue I was facing is there was not enough tissue on the current fineal aspiration to perform testing for EML4-ALK. Is that something that is, you know, necessary to go back and do in someone who is KRAS positive? Is there any time where you would see more than one mutation? And again, does mutation status change over time?
And I'll throw in there, Tom, suppose she had never had a KRAS test and she was a non-smoker, would that make it different?
So I would say, to answer a couple questions, yes, it would make a difference. I think that in general, there are 4 mutations now that I think we believe are what we would call actionable. So you've got KRAS, not because there's anything good we can do about it, but because it tells us that it's a particularly challenging type of lung cancer to treat.
Just to clarify, does that pretty much rule out EGFR mutations?
No, it does not. Oh, yes, yes. So in general, these mutations are exclusive of one another. With that said, in 8 years of doing this, we've probably seen 4 patients who had an EGFR mutation and a KRAS mutation that I've heard about at meetings. I've seen 1 personally. So it's not zero, but it's pretty close to zero because you're looking, that's in a subset of thousands of people who've been tested. So you're looking at a very, very unlikely event that they have a secondary mutation. So the 4 key mutations are KRAS, EGFR, the EML4-ALK translocation, and the ROS1 translocation. Those 4 are the ones that we think are crucial. 3 of them are usually seen in never smokers or light smokers, which would be EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. And the other key thing is that the driver mutation stays there the whole time. So I think if you tested her again, you'd find KRAS there again. And I don't think you're obligated to go back and test for EML4-ALK. I think with KRAS being present and her being a smoker, the odds of her having EML4-ALK or ROS1, I think, are amazingly small in this setting. But if she was a never smoker and didn't have KRAS, then I think you're perfectly justified to go back and test again. And I think that makes a lot of sense. In this case, the real question from my perspective is she salvageable with chemoradiotherapy? Can everything be located in 1 radiotherapy port? And do you think you have a chance at curative therapy? And do we believe that we can really cure patients who have a local regional relapse 2 years later?
Her PET CT scan showed no other evidence of disease outside of this one area, and we actually did elect to treat her with combined modality therapy similar to the SWOG regimen with the etoposide and cisplatin in combination with radiation therapy.
Sort of a related question, Jyothi, that we're getting a lot is which patients should be tested for mutations? Do you test them all at once, or do you do EGFR first or KRAS first and then reflex testing? Do you just do non-smokers? Do you do non-squamous? What's your sort of global approach to testing right now?
So this changes every week practically for me. So currently, our practice is to do reflex testing for all patients with non-squamous tumors. And as of last week, everything happened at once. 2 weeks ago, patients had multiplexed EGFR and RAS testing, and then a week later would have ALK testing in-house. And ROS1 we're sending out currently, and that's, you know, a very small N. But again, my sense is that you don't find it unless you look. I've certainly been fooled by patients who are current smokers who have EGFR mutations. It is now, with the amount of tissue you need and multiplex testing, we try to test everyone. I only test patients with squamous cell tumors if they are never smokers.
Which I gather doesn't happen too often.
But infrequent.
Pathologists can be wrong.
Right.
I mean, not wrong. They can make a mistake.
Right.
Sampling errors.
Sampling errors.
So just to kind of finish out on this and kind of get it out on the table, you mentioned ROS1, Tom. Can you tell us the story that just started to unfold the last few months, what it is?
So ROS1 is a tyrosine kinase, which was found to be involved as an oncogenic driver mutation in non-small cell lung cancer. The group at Mass General, led by John Iafredi and Alice Shaw, showed that you could demonstrate ROS1 translocations in lung cancer cells using FISH. And when you found those cells, ROS1 as a kinase is highly sensitive to crizotinib. And if you look at the inhibition of the enzyme, the inhibition is just as potent, if not more so, of ROS1 than it is with the ALK kinase. And so some very impressive responses have occurred in patients with ROS1. When they went back and looked to see frequency, ROS1 is substantially less common than ALK as a translocation. So Jody's comment that it's rare, even in the world of never smoking lung cancer. I still haven't seen one yet. I don't know if you have, Jody, but it's they're rare.
Is the testing for ROS1 pretty straightforward?
It's a FISH test that's challenging. We send it to Mass General still, so we're not doing it yet at Yale. In fact, I haven't heard of anyone doing it outside of MGH at this point.
So every now and then.
Where do you send yours?
Colorado.
Colorado. So Colorado's doing it then too.
Every now and then, as a matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, an investigator was presenting a case to me of a non-smoker who did not have an EGFR ALK mutation. If you look at those patients, what fraction, Tom, of ROS1?
5%, maybe 4 or 5%.
Wow. So it's still not very common.
Right.
And maybe just to follow that up, Tom, are all the EGFR mutations sensitive to EGFR TKIs?
So they're not. So that's a great question. They do not confer equal sensitivity because we know that most of the exon 20 mutations tend to confer resistance. When I have a patient who has a mixed picture, both a sensitizing mutation and a resistance mutation, I tend to still treat with tyrosine kinase inhibitor, but with a real close eye on the patient because I know I'm not going to get the kind of response that I want to get traditionally from someone who doesn't carry a resistance mutation. The one source I would go to is My Cancer Genome, which is William Powell's website. He has cataloged the responsiveness of over 100 EGFR mutations at My Cancer Genome. And you can go there because as we do more and more of this testing, we learn about these unusual mutations that occur at very low incidence. And he's able to tell you, give you a sense of what that confers in terms of resistance or not in that setting.
Before we go on to Louis's case, any other questions that have come up, particularly about mutation testing? I think, Eric, you were telling me you're having problems getting ALK testing.
Yeah, kind of a real-world oncology question here. Dr. Patel mentioned multiplex testing. And my question is, how much tissue is actually needed? What happens in our tumor boards? We have our tumor board every Wednesday morning, and we discuss all these cases. And our pathologists consistently, and they're good pathologists, but they consistently bemoan the lack of tissue that they have. And I'd like to know really how much tissue it takes. We've gotten to the point where it's very rare that I'll actually send a patient to a pulmonologist for a bronchoscopy because we just don't get enough tissue. But on the other hand, it's not benign to send somebody to a cardiothoracic surgeon to get a larger mass of tissue. So if we're able to multiplex these tests now, you know, how much is actually needed? I've actually talked to the drug rep, the crizotinib industry representative, about this, and they explained to me that there is or at least at that time, this was 6 months ago, there was required a little more tissue to do EML4 ALK testing. And I hadn't realized that. I thought it was a simple probe.
Jyothi?
I think you bring up great points. I think pulmonologists with an eye to what lung cancer therapy is now can get adequate tissue with vigorous cores, but many of them don't know what we're doing and still just do brushings and give us 5 cells and want an answer. And for those patients, I mean, certainly we rebiopsy all the time. And I think patients are willing to undergo rebiopsy if they understand why or what's on the line. We have been fairly successful actually using interventional radiology for our cores. The pathologist that I call and complain to all day long gave me a picture of 1 grain of salt, which is 10 times bigger than the 3 cores we get from IR. And he was like, you want this much information? I want IHC. And or genotypic testing. Suffice it to say, I think for EGFR and RAS with PCR, we need just a few cells. From cytology, you can do this, from pleural fluid. For ALK testing, my pathologists usually want 5 slides at least. But I
agreed.
Estella?
Yeah, for older patients that you can't get tissue, is there any usefulness to that Bayesdorf testing, like peripheral blood testing for EGFR sensitivity?
And what is Bayesdorf?
So Bayesdorf testing is a proteomics test to be able to look for a proteomic pattern that is consistent with response to EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. You know, I have not used the Bayesdorf test. It doesn't mean it's not a valid test. So I still feel more comfortable with tissue. But perhaps if you have someone where getting a biopsy is incredibly challenging and they've got bad cardiac disease or you're very nervous about that, could it be a good surrogate marker? It might be. That's an interesting idea.
Is there anything else commercially available sera-wise that can be helpful other than the Bayesdorf? Is that it? What happened to the thing, you know, that came out of Mass General with that whole thing?
Circulating tumor
cells.
Yeah,
right.
So circulating tumor cells, the MGH did a lot of work on this several years ago. In fact, Daniel Haber's group is still working on circulating tumor cells. The issue with circulating tumor cells, and J&J has a technology that's out there that's commercially available that any of us can order in our practice. The challenging thing with circulating tumor cells is the technology is really challenging. It's very hard to reproducibly detect reproducible numbers of circulating tumor cells. In experimental systems, people have shown very nicely that you can get circulating tumor cells, that you can molecularly profile the cancers, and that this molecular profile may confer prognostic information. So in the future, once that technology gets ironed out, I think, Estelle, the kind of patient you're describing, obtaining circulating tumor cells may be one way of doing that. I personally think the technology has gone a little bit slower than I would have guessed 5 years ago. I would have guessed that by now we'd be doing this pretty routinely, and we're not. So it's challenging to be able to do this.
Okay, Luis, can you present your patient?
I had a 60-year-old lady I'm following for the last 5 years. Originally, she presented to her primary oncologist with a RAI tumor and a metastatic adenopathy in 2007. So in 2007, she was staged as a stage 3A because of metastatic adenopathy, and she received cisplatinum and docetaxel concomitant with radiation therapy, and she achieved remission in 2007. The patient came to my practice in 2009 because she had a relapse in the area of the metastatinum in 3 different areas, and she wanted to transfer the care to us. She was totally asymptomatic, and she had a questionable metastasis in the adrenal area. At that time, the PET scan was positive, and we didn't know it was metastatic or no. When we reviewed the doses of the radiation, she had full doses, and they were unable to give any more radiation. So as we were thinking about systemic therapy.
And you had noted that it wasn't really feasible to get more tissue and do mutation testing. Jyothi, what about an empiric trial of an EGFR TKI?
I would not give her erlotinib up front unless I knew she was mutation positive. It sounds like this was sort of a slow percolation of events, so maybe I would have tried to get some more tissue if she was hesitant about chemotherapy. I probably would have encouraged her to do another biopsy.
Without any more tissue, how would you approach treatment at that point?
It's been so long. I mean, she was 5. She relapsed in 2009 or just relapsed
2009.
Now? She relapsed in 2009.
So it was 2 years after.
So 2 years. So I likely would have treated her with carboplatin and a doublet.
Which doublet and what about Bev?
I think carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab would be reasonable. She's had a lot of docetaxel. I assume she probably had some consolidation. So more likely I would have given her cisplatin, pemetrexed or carboplatin, pemetrexed. Probably in 2009, not bevacizumab with that.
How about today?
Probably not yet.
So what would you do with a patient like this today, exactly?
So again, I would have gotten more tissue. And then if she were truly mutation negative or she had no targetable mutations today, I would have started carboplatin and pemetrexed.
Without Bev?
Without Bev.
Tom, how do you think through a case like this? We're obviously moving towards trying to get how you treat EGFR, ALK, and ROS wild patients' metastatic disease and what your long-term plan sort of is in these patients. How do you approach a patient like this?
I think very similar to what Jody said. I think that I would hope that there'd be more tissue. You know, the 2 years is enough that I'd probably do exactly what Jody said, which is retreat with platinum. If it was 8 months and the person was EGFR positive by FISH, I can't believe I'm saying this, you do have an indication for erlotinib. It's a second line agent. And if it's within that 6 to 8 month period of your initial treatment, I don't think it's criminal to use erlotinib in that setting. 2 years later, I wouldn't. 2 years later, I would do what Dr. Patel said. I would go back and
Nowadays, probably for sure, no, we would have tested her and put her on erlotinib. But remember, in 2009, when YurTag was not published yet, and so frontline therapy with TKI was not standard.
But it's not frontline. She had chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. So 2 years, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
I for metastatic disease. Yes. So that's why even being positive in 2009, maybe we would not have given her erlotinib. So
just to be clear, though, how are you approaching patients with EGFR wild metastatic disease in terms of initial chemo, and do you use Bev?
I would use Bev in somebody who does not have any contraindications to Bev. As people know, just this week, there's an article in JAMA that is getting a lot of media attention, which is looking at the use of bevacizumab in people over the age of 70, that suggests that, you know, the headline is Bev doesn't work in people over 70, and the survival benefit they found using Sierra Medicare data was about a 9.3 months for receiving Bev, 8.4 months for not receiving Bev. I would argue that's exactly what you would expect. Bev is a modestly active drug in the best case scenario. If you look at older patients, you probably are going to see a less benefit in that setting. So that's gotten a lot of attention in terms of its use or not use.
Jyothi, can you talk a little bit about the regimen that you published on using carbo, PEM, and BEV, and then BEV and PEM maintenance, and the so-called point break trial, and when we might see some data on that?
Sure. So to clarify, I think BEV has activity when combined with paclitaxel. I mean, we double the response rate in patients on a carbo-paclitaxel backbone, but admittedly, the survival advantage is modest at 2 months. Before 4599 was published, we developed a phase two trial based on with a second line drug at the time, pemetrexed, thinking that there perhaps would be less toxicity and better efficacy. We don't really know the histology interaction at that point. Suffice it to say, we completed a phase two study that looked promising in terms of response rates. Because pemetrexed is so well tolerated at the time, we made a decision to do a maintenance arm with pemetrexed and bevacizumab until progression or toxicity. And from that, we saw really encouraging progression-free survival. So based on that data, the phase three trial, JMHD, or Point Break as it's called, and the Point Break is about surfing in Miami. I like that.
Am I correct in saying that was based on the Keanu Reeves movie about surfing or whatever?
And Patrick Swayze, my friend.
Patrick Swayze. Yeah. Yeah. So what does that got to do with maintenance? I never was able to figure that out.
So the Point Break is when you hit the wave and you get sort of the prolonged ride. If you were a surfer,
ride.
It's what you'd want, right?
Got
right.
It. Prolonged ride. That okay, prolonged finally ride. I understand it.
So
okay.
The maintenance. The trial is a 900-person trial of the regimen that Alan Sandler developed in ECOG, carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab for 4 cycles, followed by bevacizumab maintenance versus the regimen we developed of carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab, followed by pemetrexed, bevacizumab maintenance. It's a superiority trial. The study closed to accrual last year, and we were hoping to have data for ASCO, but it's terrific. We didn't make events. Patients are doing quite well. So we won't have data until the Chicago meeting in September.
Interesting. Tom, how do you approach non-protocol decision-making in these patients? What, you know, regimen, how do you approach maintenance?
So a couple of things. So I think that Jody has outlined very nicely that paclitaxel is a perfectly reasonable drug to use with bevacizumab. I also use pemetrexed, and I think a lot of doctors, I think it depends upon what state you're in terms of whether you can use pemetrexed with bevacizumab in terms of how your carriers tend to reimburse in that setting. And I think that's a big factor in trying to decide that. In terms of maintenance, it really depends upon the circumstance. In general, I've been persuaded that the pemetrexed maintenance data looks pretty strong. And I think it's entirely reasonable off of protocol to do that. I think the patients who particularly benefit are those patients who achieve stable disease as opposed to those who have a dramatic response. But I've actually come around that I think maintenance is a very reasonable approach to non-small cell lung cancer in the first line setting off protocol.
What do we know about quality of life, Jyothi? I mean, a simple basic question, but patients getting carbo-paclitaxel Bev or carbo-paclitaxel as opposed to carbo-PEM or carbo-PEM Bev.
So from our study, we'll have a lot of information about quality of life, just anecdotally, or there are a couple of studies that are industry sponsored, also looking at decrease in toxicity with interesting endpoints. But anecdotally, I think my patients who are on pemetrexed generally have less toxicity than patients on paclitaxel. No alopecia, no neuropathy. Admittedly, about 5 to 8% of patients on pemetrexed have a rough time with significant fatigue that usually responds to dose reduction. But generally, it's pretty well tolerated. In the maintenance trials in pemetrexed, particularly in Paramount, there was really no decrease or diminishment of quality of life, although it's really hard to capture those grade 1 and subtle toxicities that add up over time.
Could you just comment a little bit more about the Paramount trial, what it looked at, and kind of what it meant to you?
The Paramount trial looked at continuation of pemetrexed after cis pemetrexed, and there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. What I actually took away from it was the patients that had the most significant benefit were those that had the initial response to therapy rather than the ones that had stable disease. So if something's working, it's likely to continue working. And maybe, again, biologically, those patients were destined to have well-controlled disease. But I'm actually more enthusiastic about doing maintenance pemetrexed when I see a patient responding rather than one with just stable disease where I feel like I haven't made a significant impact in their disease volume.
So this patient actually has a pretty interesting story. Maybe you can kind of tell us what you treated her with and what her current situation is.
What happened is at one time in 2009, I was in the University of Miami. We have our own phase 2 trial. So we put everybody on the same regimen that you had, the carboplatinum pemetrexed bevacizumab, for 6 cycles and then maintenance. So this is one of the patients that is doing well until today. She's still on maintenance, pemetrexed bevacizumab. She just got last week cycle number 40. She's in remission. It's going to be 3 years. So this is a clinical trial. We have 45 patients in the same regime. But the question that we have for you is, first, I guess it's not standard of care to you, pemetrexed bevacizumab.
Yes. It depends what your threshold for standard of care is. It's certainly on the NCCN guidelines, but it's based on a single-arm phase 2 trial. So I don't think it's standard of care. We'll hopefully have that data soon. But, you know, it's with a grain of salt. We're excited about it, but we've
and
been
the other
wrong
problem
a lot.
That, the other problem that we have never had is how long we're going to treat these people. You know, we have more than 10 patients in this study already passed cycle 30.
Right.
So, and this particularly is interesting. If you think about sort of oncology-wide, the issue of, you know, continuing duration of treatment. You have it in breast cancer with endocrine therapy. Do you give it for 5, 10 years? Rituximab maintenance and lymphoma. You know, I hear that there's some people who kind of want to keep going. There's some people who want to stop. Does this lady have any preference one way or the other? Does she want to keep going or stop?
She wants to keep going.
She wants to keep going. I hear that with a lot of people who are kind of stable. Tom, 40 cycles of maintenance. What would you be thinking?
I'm impressed. I've been very impressed, Luis. You've gotten 40 cycles of maintenance. That is really, really impressive work. And I'm also impressed that she's able to tolerate it that long. I've never experienced that yet. On the other hand, there were always a handful of patients years ago who didn't end up having mutations, but who had a much more favorable prognosis. And there were patients who you could get 6, 7 years out of, but they're very unusual. So I still would think if and when she progresses, that testing for an EGFR mutation probably still is not unreasonable. You still haven't ruled that out in that setting. And I think if she wants to continue and she's on study, I think you've done great service for her.
Jyothi?
I have a couple of patients that have done that long. Generally, I sort of start talking to them about maybe treatment every 4 weeks and getting breaks in. Generally, though, the patients that respond like this don't want to stop. I mean, they're very motivated and their families are very motivated.
But the controversy is, for example, how do you stop? You know, for example, I have a couple of patients that reached 35. They wanted to stop. And because there was something residual in the PET scan, we did biopsies. No, and biopsies were negative. That gave us some room to feel that maybe it's worth to stop. But one of them, the biopsy was positive. And that actually validates the maintenance concept, you know. And I have another patient from the time of that we used to do maintenance bevacizumab only after 41 cycles of bevacizumab, and she wanted to quit with biopsy, and the tumor is still there.
So I want to go on actually to Eric's case here, 40-year-old lady. Can you present her?
You bet. A 40-year-old woman with a strong family history for cancer. She had a mother, father, and a sister, all of whom had metastatic disease of unknown primary early on and probably didn't seek much medical treatment. So she initially presented in January of 2011 with numbness on the right side of her face. It was going down her right arm. Ended up getting an MRI in the emergency room, which showed, I counted them, 17 ring-enhancing lesions, including her brainstem and her cerebellum, and probably quite a few that were below the limits of detection. So the subsequent workup included a PET scan, which showed a 5-centimeter hypermetabolic left upper lobe lung mass with a bunch of supraclavicular, mediastinal, bilateral hilar lesions, along with, unfortunately, multiple liver lesions, axial skeletal disease, and almost all of this was symptomatic. She had pain all over. So she eventually got a biopsy of a supraclavicular lymph node, which was consistent with adenocarcinoma, and was initially treated with whole brain irradiation in February of 2011.
Did she have mutation testing?
She did not initially. This was at another facility. I inherited her later, but no, she did not at that point in time. She switched to carboplatin paclitaxel because of toxicities. I guess she was in that group that Dr. Patel mentioned that didn't tolerate the pemetrexed very well. And to be honest with you, she didn't really tolerate anything. So she got the pemetrexed cisplatin followed by carboplatin paclitaxel. And then around the third or fourth cycle, they added bevacizumab.
So just relevant to this question of need for CME, and I don't know what your perception was in terms of what was going on in the other hospital, but Tom, we're talking about February 2011, a year ago, 40-year-old woman who's a non-smoker who hasn't had any mutation testing.
I mean, I would have liked to have seen mutation testing at that point. I mean, I think that if I knew she was an EGFR mutant, I probably would start with erlotinib and probably not with whole brain radiation, even with 17 lesions. But again, you know, it's hard to go back and change.
Just to pick up on that, Jyothi, do you agree in terms of withholding whole brain radiation in a patient who has an EGFR mutation?
We generally do.
Really? Even with somebody who is symptomatic like her?
Because this is exactly the patient who could live 5 to 6 to 7 years. And 5 to 6, 7 years after whole brain. Now, granted, she's 39, so she probably doesn't have very much vascular disease yet. She's probably not going to get dementia. But early in the whole course of the EGFR story, we treated people with whole brain radiation, then gave them erlotinib or gefitinib. And the number of patients I had who had substantial cognitive decline was very large, particularly in older patients. Because, you know, most of our metastatic lung cancer patients don't live 5 to 6 years afterwards to have the effects of whole brain.
So she was very symptomatic from the standpoint of her CNS lesions. How long does it take, as opposed to whole brain irradiation, for the erlotinib to help with those symptoms?
So by saying that, I don't mean to be cavalier. I think I would start steroids. I would give erlotinib at the same time. I would follow her like a hawk. And in some patients, you're not going to get away with it. Okay, in some patients, you will have to give radiation, either stereotactic or whole brain radiation. So I'm not trying to say that you can do this for everybody, but I at least would try my best to see if we could get away. There are several examples of very nice responses in the CNS to primary erlotinib-based therapy.
Just out of curiosity, how would you compare the responses that you see in the CNS to responses that you see in people with EGFR mutations with, you know, systemic disease?
I think it's very similar.
Jyothi?
I would agree with that. We've even seen patients with great responses who present with leptomeningeal disease, which, you know, is always so difficult. But one thing to concur with what Tom was saying, that the rapidity of response with erlotinib is amazing, like 5 to 7 days, which is exactly what you would imagine for radiation. So it's not that you're waiting too long.
Steve?
Would you use the standard dose erlotinib, or would you do the higher dose pulse erlotinib that has been talked about for patients with the CNS metastasis?
It's a great question. I would use a standard dose erlotinib, but I was at a fantastic seminar this week by Jeff Engelman from MGH, who talked about how we should be rethinking our use of kinase inhibitors in general, and we really should be thinking about pulse dosing as a way of taking advantage of signaling technology and what's happening inside the cell. But in this setting, I would go with the standard dose. But I keep an open mind. Maybe a couple of years from now, we're going to be going to more pulse doses of kinase inhibitors.
Just out of curiosity, I always thought the pulse dose thing was about trying to get a higher dose so you get more drug in the CNS. Is there any reason to think, sort of with systemic disease, a pulse dosing makes sense?
Just that you may allow cells to go through apoptosis better, and there may be a rationale for giving pulse dose as a way of, and you may actually paradoxically delay the emergence of resistance. This is theoretical. It's not proven yet.
I want to actually bring this case up to date and get more input in it, but just one other sort of follow-up question in terms of this issue of rapidity of response. You know, we talked about the fact that we like to poll investigators, and one of the things that we just did a poll on, Tom was talking about, was the question of the patient who, let's say, you know, has an EGFR mutation, but is very symptomatic. You know, they have extensive lung disease, they're short of breath. Jyothi, is there any reason, you know, in breast cancer, sometimes that kind of situation will get people to use chemo before hormones because of this thinking it works faster. What about in terms of these patients?
I think for patients who are EGFR mutated, erlotinib is faster than chemotherapy, and they're more likely to respond. So you want to give them the best option. As a lung cancer oncologist, you sound a little bit ridiculous, particularly when you're meeting them in the intensive care unit and talking to the pulmonologist about how you're going to get the erlotinib down the Dabhoff.
Wow. Okay, Eric, can you bring us up to date?
Sure. So after not tolerating the treatments very well, but having some clinical response, her boyfriend, now her husband, brought her in to see me for a second opinion. And I called the pathologist and requested retrospective testing of her sample for EGFR and ALK, and it came back, not surprisingly, positive for EGFR. So I started her on erlotinib in July. And within a couple of months, she'd had a dramatic response, further dramatic clinical response. And in addition, she was tolerating the therapy better. I did a surveillance PET scan and MRI in October, so about 3 months after starting therapy. And the radiologists, you know, called me personally and asked me if it was the same patient. It was one of those situations. So she had a surveillance scans that showed a really nice response. Then, unfortunately, in March of this year, she started to complain of worsening weakness throughout her body and bone pains. And this had sort of been coming up, you know, in January, February, you know, when we adjusted some pain medicine that she had been on, and I felt like some of it was related to that. But by March, it became clear to me that something else was going on, and it was time for her surveillance scans. So in addition, she had this tremor, and she'd always had this right-sided tremor ever since her disease was diagnosed. It had gotten much better when I started the erlotinib, and now it was starting to come back visibly. And this is a tremor that is in the right side of her lips and the right side of her hand going all the way down. So I repeated her MRI, and she was found to have a new 1 centimeter lesion in her brain. And I also did a bone scan on her because she was having this all-over body pain that was not severe, but certainly progressive, and unfortunately, she appeared to have substantial progression of her known bony disease. So this is now 9 months into erlotinib therapy, and she is unfortunately progressing through erlotinib. So my question is, where do you go from here?
Common question.
I would definitely give stereotactic radiosurgery to the brain lesion. I think that's the easy part.
Yeah, but she's received that already.
So that's the easy part. How many bone mets are we talking about? More than two or three that are growing?
They aren't even discrete bone mets. It's just diffuse axial skeletal disease, correct?
So in this setting, I think your best chance is to do everything you can to get her on a study of cetuximab and afatinib, okay? So afatinib is a dual kinase inhibitor. A dual kinase inhibitor that inhibits EGFR and HER2. It's an irreversible inhibitor. It's a drug which we should have some data coming out this year that looks at it in first-line setting of lung cancer compared to chemotherapy, a study from Asia that we're awaiting the results of. There's data now that shows that afatinib plus cetuximab is our best second-line option, regardless of what the resistance is due to, whether resistance is due to T790M or not due to T790M. What I would like to do in this setting, if possible, I would love to biopsy this person because you could learn something from the biopsy that would change your opinion. For example, this person has a 15% chance of having small cell as their histology. If they had small cell, you would eagerly give the person cis or carbo plus etoposide, depending upon your favorite regimen for small cell.
Could you just elaborate a little bit more on this small cell transformation and where you see it?
So about 15% of EGFR mutants, when they progress, if you biopsy, you can find small cell lung cancer phenotype. They still maintain the EGFR mutation. The driving mutation is still there when you look inside the small cell, but they can respond to chemotherapy for small cells. So that's one of the reasons why I think that has importance. The other thing is you may find MET amplification. If you found MET amplification, you may go down a different road toward treating the relapse, and you might want to consider using a MET inhibitor or looking for a trial that has a MET inhibitor as an option at that point. If, let's say, you said, you know, the patient says, no way do I want a clinical trial, I refuse to do a clinical trial, what would I do next? Depending upon the amount of progression, if you're telling me there are 20 or 30 spots that are growing, I would probably stop the erlotinib and add chemo. If you told me there were 3 to 5 spots that were growing, I would probably continue the erlotinib and add chemotherapy at that point. And it would be whatever your favorite second-line chemotherapy is. You've already given her carbo-pem, carbo-taxol. You're probably looking at something with gemcitabine. Yeah.
Although she didn't do well on chemotherapy, you mentioned trying to get her in a trial of afatinib, cetuximab. Like, where would he look? Could you get a patient in a trial like that?
So we filled ours up right now. So I would go to clinicaltrials.gov. We actually had an open study with afatinib and cetuximab that was open, which has closed about a month ago. And there are one or two trials that are open still with that combination. Cetuximab obviously is commercially available. Afatinib, our hope is it will get approved in first line, and that will allow some off-label use in this setting. But again, we don't know the results of the trial. We don't know if it will be approved in first line. There's a lot that's unknown at this point, but it's by far the most exciting regimen. Vince Miller, Greg Riley, the group at Memorial, along with a number of other people, have published on this. It's a very exciting new regimen.
Just to clarify, though, what theoretically you could do erlotinib and cetuximab?
There's really no evidence that erlotinib and cetuximab would have benefit in this setting. So I would not do erlotinib and cetuximab in this setting. This is all based on some terrific mouse modeling work that William Pao, who's now at Vanderbilt, and Katie Politi, who's now at Yale, did when they were postdocs for Harold Varmus in Harold Varmus's lab, where they did some really exciting mouse modeling suggesting that this combination was able to overcome acquired resistance. And initially, they thought it was just T790M that benefited. Now we know that T790M is interesting, but the non-T790M patients seem to respond just as well as the T790M patients did.
And do we have any update? The only thing I've seen was last ASCO where
awesome
they presented
waterfall.
That.
Yeah.
Is there any other group that's looked at it? Was there any follow-up to that trial? And also that trial, you know, you see numbers, incredible waterfall plot. Most of these patients responded. But did you have any feeling or from your own practice what it meant clinically? Were these useful responses?
So I don't have any additional data to share. I do know that the responses are the kinds of responses. They're 6 to 9 month responses, and then you develop resistance at that point. So they're not cures in that setting. But what's interesting in a lot of these cases is that you can also go back to the well sometimes. So, you know, you can use afatinib cetuximab for a while. Maybe you find a small cell phenotype when you biopsy again. You can go back and consider reusing erlotinib down the road. So I think we're going to see a fair amount of rotation of therapies and using repeat biopsies to drive treatment. I think that's very important in EGFR mutated cancers, is using repeat biopsies to drive treatment. And I believe that it's clinically indicated to do that now, not just for research.
Just to clarify a little bit more too, when you hear erlotinib cetuximab, you think about theoretically, pretty bad dermatologic possibilities. What about afatinib cetuximab?
So that's a great point. Mario LaCantore, the dermatologist, I think, Neil, you've worked with Mario
sure.
in programs before. It can cause skin toxicities and GI bowel toxicities. It's not as easy a regimen as erlotinib alone, obviously, and it's something that you want to be watching very carefully with your patients.
So just to follow up, Jyothi, how do you approach, in general, patients who've had EGFR mutations, great responses, and now progression?
I'd echo a lot of what Tom says. I think one thing to understand is patients with T790 mutations can also do quite well. Greg Oxnard has sort of published survival curves that look better from the onset of resistance. These patients do better than sort of your average patient with non-small cell lung cancer. Our group, Melissa Johnson, is working with Greg Riley doing a phase 1 trial looking at an HSP90 inhibitor, AUY922, in combination with erlotinib, and that's a chaperone protein. So you sort of restore that genotypic driver with erlotinib. So far, we haven't seen a lot of toxicity. We haven't seen a lot of great responses, but it may be that, again, if you have a small amount of response to restore stable disease or durability of response might be okay. In general, if these patients have just oligometastatic progression, so progression in one area in the skeleton or something, I'll just give radiation and continue the erlotinib. And I, too, will often sort of interchange. If the patients are tolerating erlotinib and they have multiple sites of systemic progression, I'll probably do single agent therapy and continue erlotinib, sometimes drop it to 100 or 75, and then give them 4 cycles of chemotherapy and get back to the erlotinib, because there is selection of different cells in patients that I need to, I guess, hit a little harder with doublet chemotherapy. Usually stop the erlotinib and then go back on erlotinib as maintenance.
Luis?
I have a quick question. Now when the patients have an EGFR mutation, we put them on erlotinib, they fail. Now the biopsy report, the second one, half of the time comes with 790. will you continue with erlotinib in these people, or you only continue if you get the other 50% that you don't know if it's 790?
If it's T790, I actually continue the erlotinib by and large and then you look for a trial. Right. You know, we've picked up a couple of patients with small cell transformation. They act differently. They have more rapid progression of disease. And for those patients, I stop the erlotinib completely and do chemotherapy. One question to ask, was this patient on any sort of bone therapy? Did you treat with a bisphosphonate or denosumab?
Yeah, she's been receiving zoledronic acid.
Jethi, any thoughts about bone-targeted therapy in lung cancer, and what about denosumab?
So I usually give bone-targeted therapy when my fellow tells me to. I usually forget because, one, most of our patients with non-small cell lung cancer, I don't think, live 3 or 4 or 5 years to suffer pathologic fractures. So by and large, if someone has asymptomatic, low-volume disease, I treat the cancer and do chemotherapy alone. For patients who have painful bony metastasis or who have known bone lesions in the femur or in the pelvis, sometimes I'll go ahead and start. I am still using primarily bisphosphonates in patients who have good creatinine clearance. I tend to use denosumab in patients who fail that indicator. Again, for our patients, I don't think one is better than another. And our patients are getting infusional therapy by and large anyway, so adding the other infusion compared to the subcutaneous injection, I don't think changes their lives.
Maggie, just out of curiosity, right now, how do you approach bone-targeted therapy, metastatic lung, but particularly metastatic breast? Are you using a lot of denosumab?
I am not using a lot of denosumab, except for patients with renal insufficiency. I mean, there is a convenience factor. I mean, if I'm somebody who has bone-only disease and they're getting Faslodex, well, then it's easy to give them a sub-Q injection and not give them the long infusion. But if they're already getting infusional chemotherapy like you, I tend to just give them another infusion.
Tom, how do you approach bone-targeted therapy? And are there patients with bone mets, but again, because of the natural history of disease, where you just don't do it?
I think Jody's completely correct. I think that for those patients who've got a high burden of bone disease, I do think zoledronic acid is a very reasonable option. I have not been using denosumab only because I haven't been using it. I can't tell you that that's right or wrong. It just hasn't become my personal habit yet. And I think it's a bigger issue in someone like your patient with EGFR mutation who may live 3 to 4 years to develop bone fractures.
So maybe we can just introduce a mini case slash question. Linda, can you talk about your 66-year-old man?
The bottom line question, is there any data about pemetrexed with radiation? This was a gentleman with metastatic disease, but he had symptomatic chest wall involvement and so wanted to give radiation with chemotherapy. And I gave him carboplatin and paclitaxel, but again, wondering if there was any data regarding pemetrexed with radiation.
So, Jyothi, that kind of leads to the whole issue of choice of chemo to put into chemo radiation. How do you approach that right now, and what about this issue of PEM?
So I think we have a good bit of data with pemetrexed and curative dose radiation in the CLGB study by Govindan that probably you participated in, Tom, has also led to a phase 3 registration trial of cis-pemetrexed versus cis-etoposide for patients. And by and large, it's very well tolerated. We just need to find out if it's better.
You give full doses of PEM too.
Right. So the idea is that you can give full systemic doses and really obviate some of the myelosuppression and the esophagitis and the pneumonitis. I haven't seen much pneumonitis. We did a phase 1 where we were actually able to get to 800 of pemetrexed with 75 of cisplatin every 4 weeks with radiation and sort of 3B4 patients. 5 years ago. Certainly for patients who have stage 4 disease in whom we need some radiation and systemic treatment yesterday, I feel very comfortable giving carboplatin and pemetrexed and concurrent radiation to either the chest wall or a bony site and have not run into significant difficulties with it. Perhaps there may be a delay of a cycle by a week or so if we end up with any myelosuppression.
What about end stage 3B disease, and what about continuing chemo beyond chemo radiation?
So for stage 3B disease, when we were attempting sort of curative therapy, there are patients that I will treat off of study occasionally with cisplatin pemetrexed, and I'll do it as the trial JMIG is scheduled, so the 4 cycles of cisplatin pemetrexed followed by continuation pemetrexed, but I usually can't get in more than 2 cycles back, similar to other consolidation data.
Tom, what about your approach to choice of chemo with chemo radiation stage 3B?
So for good performance status patients, I still like the SWOG 50-50, using etoposide platinum, splitting the platinum on day 1, day 8, giving etoposide days 1 through 5 with radiotherapy. And those are patients who I would treat with cisplatin. For the non-cisplatin patients, I still use carboplatin and paclitaxel. Everything Dr. Patel said, I agree with. I don't think there's a reason you couldn't consider using one of the other agents. And since Yale just joined SWOG, we're from actually the southwest part of Connecticut. That's the way to justify it. Since Yale just joined SWOG, I feel even better about the regimen.
So Linda, maybe you can also verbalize an issue you brought up to me in our case preparation teleconference before this meeting, namely lung cancer screening.
Well, this has come up in our tumor boards, and people are coming to us in various means with preoperative chest x-rays that are abnormal or whatever, and then it comes up, now that we have this data as far as the benefit of screening high-risk patients, how should we incorporate that as a pulmonary program? And what are oncologists and radiologists going to do as far as what defines a low-dose CT? And again, how is this going to be incorporated as an early diagnostic approach?
So I'm kind of curious, Jyothi, for your take on this. Maybe you can just comment a little bit on what the big 50,000 patient trial looked at, showed, and kind of what do you think it means?
So the National Lung Screening Trial looked at a very specific population of patients, so patients who are 55 to 74, again, over 50,000 patients who had had at least a 30-pack year tobacco history, or current smokers who had quit within the past 15 years, so people that we would all think would be at very high risk. The trial was impressive, so patients ended up getting either CT scan annually for 3 years or a chest x-ray. There was a 20% reduction in all-cause mortality in patients who were CT screened and 7% in lung cancer mortality, which is huge for a screening test. Unfortunately, there were many, many patients with false positives, and over a quarter of patients ended up getting a workup for a false positive result. I think that's going to be the challenge with implementation. So the investigators that were in the National Lung Screening Trial, such as the radiologist I work with, has a very, very rigorous sort of kickoff method in following these patients, how much of a change there is, even what patient should get a PET scan versus just a CT scan. I think that is going to be the difficulty in implementation in terms of cost. So NLST, I think, was very strict, and we found very nice results. Off of that, you know, NCCN, again, I'm a panel member, not of the screening guidelines, but they really opened it up. So patients who are over 50 and have a personal history of smoking of only 20 pack years, and one of several other high-risk features, such as secondhand smoke exposure, family history of smoking, history of occupational exposure, or pulmonary fibrosis, all of those patients should be screened as well, according to NCCN. And I don't think we have any data to support this. We're looking at a lot of other groups, like the National Preventative Task Force, to guide us a little bit more in who should be screened. But certainly, I think it's going to be difficult. I will say at our institution, which was an NLST participant, the uptake has been slow. So internists still sort of look at this technology and are not convinced that we are doing our medical system a favor. As an oncologist, this is the one thing that works. And so, again, talking in the House of Medicine, not always so easy.
So quick comment from Tom as a cancer center director. I'm sure you've kind of gotten into this. I kind of sometimes feel a little bit of closet skepticism about breast cancer screening and not sure about this one.
So I actually was very enthusiastic about the results of the screening trial. What we've done is we've established a screening clinic through the pulmonary department. But one of the things we think is crucial is linking it to smoking cessation. So we actually have a very active smoking cessation clinic as well. And we have not been offering screening unless patients also participate in the smoking cessation approach. Doesn't mean they'll all stop smoking, but that we think that one of the fears that's out there is that smokers will think, well, I've got the screening test. This is fantastic. I can just go ahead and get my scans. Which, you know, 80% of the people still got lung cancer, okay? You know, I mean, it reduced mortality by 20%, not 100%. So I think that smoking cessation is important to target with it. But I would agree with Jyothi. I think that the uptake from the internal medicine community has been slow. And again, Neil, this comes down to unmet educational need. I know there's skepticism, but I also think that people are not fully aware of the data in lung cancer screening at this point, from an internal medicine standpoint.
So Steve, can you present your 63-year-old lady?
This is a 63-year-old white female who approximately 3.5 years ago, at the end of 2008, presented with a cough, ultimately was noted to have a left upper lobe lung nodule. Preoperative staging, PET CT scan, mediastinoscopy were negative, and underwent a left upper lobectomy. Final pathology revealed a 0.9 centimeter moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. She received no adjuvant therapy at that time. She underwent routine follow-up, and 2.5 years later, on a follow-up PET CT scan, she was noted to have recurrent disease in the left hilum, as well as in the adrenal gland. A CT-guided biopsy of the adrenal gland confirmed recurrent adenocarcinoma, which was TTF1 positive. Patient's significant history is she was hypertensive and she had been an insulin-dependent diabetic for over 20 years and was a brittle diabetic on an insulin pump and, you know, with frequent monitoring of her blood sugars.
So first, maybe just going back to the adjuvant situation, Jyothi, is interesting. 0.9 centimeter tumor, didn't get adjuvant therapy. Actually, Dr. Jablons also recently reported, you know, the beginnings of an oncotype in lung cancer. To me, is RT-PCR assay, looking to see if you could pick out high-risk patients. But what about patients, just before we get to the treatment of metastatic disease, looking back in her adjuvant situation, where are we in terms of trying to identify these people who have small node negative lesions and yet relapse?
Unfortunately, it's almost a 1 in 4 chance of patients who we don't treat with chemotherapy that they'll relapse. Certainly trying chemotherapy has not been effective. If we look at all comers, the LACE meta-analysis suggests we actually hurt patients. So I would have not offered her chemotherapy. But we have a lot of work to do because it's very difficult saying that you have a substantial chance of recurrence and there's nothing to do. Certainly the work in CLGB is sort of picking those stage ones is interesting. Now, even if this patient ended up having a marker that we know would respond to chemotherapy, so potentially was EGFR positive, I think several years ago, there was some enthusiasm for giving adjuvant erlotinib to these patients. I think things have really changed in the past 2 years, feeling that maybe giving adjuvant erlotinib again is deleterious and may select for bad actors.
So, Jyothi, what about treatment in this situation? I mean, there's certainly a lot of people with lung cancer who have diabetes. This lady has, you know, brittle diabetes, insulin pump. But how do you approach these kind of patients in terms of choice of chemotherapy?
So certainly these patients have a lot of comorbidities and often have underlying neuropathy and renal dysfunction. So often taxanes are off the table completely. Often pemetrexed's off the table because of creatinine clearance. And even with pemetrexed, you do need some dexamethasone premedication for rash, although we successfully are able to usually take that down to maybe 4 milligrams a day. If she sort of flunks those criteria, then I'd probably treat her with carboplatin and gemcitabine. But if I could, if her creatinine would allow it, I'd probably treat her with carboplatin pemetrexed.
What would you be thinking, Tom?
Same thing. I mean, I think that it depends. You know, brittle diabetes is brittle diabetes. It depends upon how tough it is. If it really is brittle diabetes, I think gemcitabine is a perfectly reasonable option if you really want to avoid steroids altogether. And I don't think that's crazy in that setting.
Could you tell us what happened?
Sure. She did have some retinopathy and some mild renal insufficiency, creatinine clearance in the 35 milliliter per minute range. So that took pemetrexed off the map in terms of treatment choices. And interestingly, she did not have any significant neuropathy. And we went back and forth between choices and ended up treating her with nab-paclitaxel on a weekly basis and carboplatin every 3 weeks. And I actually also did go test the original tumor. She was negative for KRAS, EGFR, and EML4 ALK mutations. And she did very well, tolerated well, really developed just a grade 1 peripheral neuropathy, completed a total of 6 cycles with a significant partial response, and is actually currently on observation and stable at the present time. Certainly gemcitabine would be my next option if and when she relapses.
So Tom, what do we know about nab-paclitaxel in non-small cell?
Mark Szczesinski's done some nice work with nab-paclitaxel in lung cancer that suggests that it is at least as good as paclitaxel in lung cancer. And I wish I had thought about it as an option for this patient earlier, and I'm glad you did.
Anything about, we'll talk later about the conundrum of squamous cell and where that's heading. There was a suggestion, I think, in some of the NAB data that Mark Szczesinski presented that maybe greater benefit with squamous cell. What are your thoughts about that?
So I think that squamous cell gemcitabine will continue to have a major role in treatment of squamous cell. I think nab-paclitaxel will emerge as a role. I think the biggest thing in squamous cell cancers is going to be that these seem to be tumors that do better with the immune therapies. So anti-PD-1, anti-PD-1 ligand, CTLA-4, ipilimumab, these drugs, if they find a place in lung cancer, it may well be in squamous cell cancer that you find a place for that. The other thing we're looking forward to is this summer we should have published more data from the Cancer Genome Atlas that will begin to show us some genomic patterns in squamous cell. FGF, fibroblast growth factor, has been found to be implicated in squamous cell cancers. And there are some drugs which are FGF inhibitors that look very promising in squamous cell.
So agree or disagree? Maybe early evidence suggesting there might be a lot of driver mutations in patients with squamous cell.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you. Just beginning, I spoke to Dr. Goodman, and he's going to present some data at ASCO about this, but just sort of qualitatively, he was saying these are different than the driver mutations you see in adeno.
Yes, the driver mutations appear different in this setting. And the dramatic benefit we're seeing with PD-1 in squamous cell makes you wonder, are there tumor antigens that are more easily processed by the immune system? Are there other things about squamous cell that will make it more likely to be successfully treated by turning off immune tolerance?
So, Steve, it's interesting how people see nab-paclitaxel on paper, so to speak. It seems to at least have the advantage of avoiding corticosteroids, which for your patient with diabetes was huge, but maybe more marginal on many other patients. And then there's the issue of cost that enters the decision.
I think it's largely driven by economics. I think the cost of nab-paclitaxel is significant compared to certainly standard paclitaxel and even to some of the other drugs that we use in lung cancer or breast cancer. And for most patients, I would say the steroid premedication is not a major issue. And a lot of times, as Dr. Patel already said, you can dial down on the steroid premedication if the patient tolerates the first one or two cycles of chemotherapy without any significant reactions.
Steve, do people with lung cancer worry about coming in weekly for the nab-paclitaxel? My sense is, at least in Chicago, so many patients with lung cancer are elderly. Their child takes a day off from work to bring them in. And, you know, there's that whole idea that perhaps a breast cancer patient is more motivated about coming into the office every week than a patient with lung cancer.
I'm in South Florida where all of the elderly drive themselves.
And, whether that's good or bad.
And, correct. It could be good or bad. And a lot of them, their schedules are filled with going to the doctor. So coming on a weekly basis usually is not a big issue for them.
So I want to go into Estella's case. You're a 67-year-old man, and there's a real practical issue here that hopefully we can put our heads together about.
So this is a 67-year-old man, former heavy smoker, with a history of hemochromatosis, and he describes about a 6-month history of some shortness of breath and fatigue and just very nonspecific complaints. Eventually, his primary doctor did a chest x-ray and found evidence of a white mediastinum and a right hilar mass. He had a PET scan that revealed evidence of mostly intrathoracic disease in the right hilum, the mediastinum, but there was also supraclavicular and lower cervical involvement. So he was evaluated at our cancer center, and our radiation oncologist staged him as having N3 disease and thought that he was not a candidate for radiation, that he had extensive stage small cell lung cancer. That was the pathology. It was small cell lung cancer. So we discussed with him treatment options, and we have currently an open study with cisplatin, etoposide, and sunitinib in the maintenance setting. So he agreed to participate in that study. And the first two cycles with cisplatin, etoposide, were a little bit rocky. He had a lot of anorexia, a lot of symptoms. And after two cycles, we follow up a CAT scan and had a complete response. At that point, we felt that he really wouldn't tolerate more cisplatin. We really had to switch him to carboplatin since he had extensive disease, although it was only intrathoracic disease. We complete the chemotherapy, and again, he maintains a complete response, and we have a decision about should we go to 6 cycles or should we stop now because he's been very debilitated by the treatment. At that point, we opt that we're going to stop the systemic chemotherapy and then proceed with prophylactic cranial radiation. So he has that. And then a month after the radiation, he still is not feeling better. Now he has neuropathy, and we don't know what came first. Now he has neuropathy, he has a low sodium, he's cognitively, he's feeling worse, like he's having trouble with memory. He just doesn't feel himself. And then another month goes by. He has sodium. We correct the sodium, the hyponatremia. And then we're starting thinking that maybe there's something else going on because he started having gait imbalance and trouble walking. And we have a neurologist evaluate him. So now we're 3 months after therapy, and this patient is feeling as sick as he did before he started all the treatment. We re-image him, and he has no evidence of disease. His PET scan's negative, MRI of the brain is negative. And the neurologist does a workup. He finds evidence of neuropathy, and we start thinking that maybe there's something else going on, like a paraneoplastic syndrome that explains all of these symptoms. So it takes a long time to get these results, but eventually we get that he has a positive anti-HU antibody. He had a titer of 1 to 640 in the serum, and then he just got admitted to have a lumbar puncture for a workup and doing the same studies in the spinal fluid. So I guess the question is, you know, someone that it's very symptomatic, you have no evidence of active disease, but you do have a very high suspicion that there's a paraneoplastic syndrome here. And this gentleman was very active and now really is almost bedbound. He really can't go out of the house by himself. He's having trouble with memory, having trouble walking. He just feels horrible. And, you know, it's triggered out of depression. So it's this whole clinical picture.
So, Tom, first of all, can you explain what anti-HU antibody of titer of 1 to 640 means and any thoughts about what you think is going on here?
So small cell lung cancer is the type of lung cancer that's most associated with a number of neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes, ranging from a myasthenic type. You can get a myasthenia type syndrome from small cell lung cancer. You also can get other antibody-mediated neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes, anti-HU being one of them, that you can have. A titer of 1 to 640 is pretty high, so it's probably not likely to be spurious. And given the scenario of what you're describing, this sounds pretty consistent with a paraneoplastic neurologic syndrome from small cell lung cancer. The challenging thing you've got in this setting is I have been incredibly unimpressed with our ability to do much in this setting. That you can get beautiful responses to small cell. You can even cure somebody of small cell lung cancer, only to have their remaining years be incredibly debilitated by these neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes.
Is this a manifestation of progressive disease?
It's not always a manifestation of progressive disease. It can be, but this all could be related to the initial presentation. Now, you haven't found progressive disease,
no.
Right? You've searched for progressive disease. Now found
he's had a complete response.
Yeah, he's had a complete response. So there's even been some data that people who have paraneoplastic neuropathies do better theoretically from this concept of immune surveillance, or there's maybe you're turning the immune system on and you're getting increased anti-tumor activity. So there are some evidence that suggests they do better from a cancer standpoint. Others have argued the reason for that is because you pick their stage up earlier because you look for the disease earlier in the course. That didn't happen in this guy's case. But I would defer to the neuro-oncologist whether steroids can be helpful in this setting. I've generally been underwhelmed. Plasmapheresis, I've generally been underwhelmed at the ability to do that. Plasma exchange, I've been underwhelmed. These are all things that have been tried. High doses of gamma globulin that have been used. These are all the tricks that the neuro-oncologist will try. And they certainly, in a guy who's only 67, who's had a CR to your therapy, are certainly worth trying. But it's a challenging scenario.
What's the pathophysiology of what's going on to have progressive symptomatology in the face of a complete response?
Well, you had a tumor. I mean, the tumor was there for a while.
Maybe stimulated some kind of
immune. You developed an immune response to the tumor, and you have now generated a substantial autoimmune disease, similar to lupus or any other autoimmune disease.
Has he ever had steroids?
He did, and it didn't help much.
I've not been impressed with steroids. I don't know what you think, Jody, but I've not been impressed with steroids do a heck of a lot in this setting.
What do you think about what's going on here, Jyothi?
I would agree. This is unusual because generally when I've met people like this, they are symptomatic at the time, and so you at least feel good about plasmapheresis in combination with chemotherapy, and so you feel like something is helping. But again, this gentleman sort of having it after his response, I would say is very unusual. And certainly at our institution, it would probably be recommended that he undergo plasmapheresis. But again, I would hold my breath that you would make his life significantly better.
Is there any institution or investigator out there, you know, actively looking at this question that you know about?
I always think of Sloan Kettering as being the place that does the most work in paraneoplastic neuro-oncology.
And there's also an investigator at Penn, right? Dal Cal.
You trained at Penn,
yeah,
right?
Penn,
Dal Cal.
What are your thoughts about this, Estelle?
One thing I know is that he feels worse after we stopped the treatment. So going back to the first case we discussed where someone had this mostly intrathoracic disease from small cell, there was a missed opportunity here to also maybe perhaps suggest radiation, although right now there's no active disease in the...
But that's a Jeremic study, right? That you treat what was there before and maybe there's a better response. Oh, it's pretty hard to radiate someone who can't walk, though.
Yeah, no, he's very symptomatic, so it's definitely going to be very difficult. But we'll go the route of either more immunosuppression or plasmapheresis, and then we'll monitor very closely for disease recurrence.
Did you work with the people at Penn who were looking into this, or do you have any contact with them?
Every so often we have cases that get presented to conference, and they get the same treatment, plasmapheresis, and sometimes you have successes, but they're very few.
Just out of curiosity, around the table, any thoughts about this case? Have you seen anything like it? Eric, any thoughts?
I have not. Louis? Not had this before.
I have a lady that limited disease, small cell lung cancer, just last year with bilateral leg weakness, and she completes CR, and then the paraneoplastic syndrome got worse.
What did you do, or what happened?
She's been followed by neurology, but as they're saying, you know, they're giving steroids, they're giving immunoglobulin, and the improvement is disappointing, you know. So,
Tom, you alluded to immune therapy. You reported on ipilimumab. There's a lot of excitement about that, obviously, in melanoma. Where do you think we're going to be in a few years in terms of immune treatment of lung cancer?
So I think you're going to see anti-PD-1, anti-PD-1 ligand, those drugs emerge as our most active drug in lung cancer. I think it'll be more active than any other single chemotherapy drug that we use in lung cancer. So I think that'll be the backbone of our treatment of lung cancer, will be immune therapies for lung cancer. I think the duration of benefit is longer than you get with chemotherapy. I think the percentage of benefit is similar to what you get with chemotherapy, at least. And these drugs are now being tested. The other reason that I'm confident they're going to be developed is there are about six companies that have drugs that look promising. So the race to get the first good immune drug in lung cancer will be high for between whether it's anti-PD-1 or whether it's going after the ligand, I think you're going to see. But we've seen at Yale impressive responses to these drugs, impressive responses in people heavily, heavily pretreated with chemotherapy.
Can you talk about sort of what PD-1 is?
So PD-1 is an important molecule that, you know, if you think about it, we have the world of the T cell. The T cell orchestrates the immune response. And turning T cells off and dampening the immune response is crucial to prevent what's happening to Estelle's patients. So, you know, the importance of having a natural system which dampens our immune system prevents all of us from getting multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease, lupus. So PD-1, its normal function is to turn off or to dampen the immune system. So if you give an antibody to PD-1 or an antibody to the ligand to PD-1, you can therefore remove that block on T cell function, and the T cell can function more appropriately to stimulate the antigen-presenting cell to turn on the immune system in a way that allows it to recognize cancers as being foreign and cause tumor regression. And there are some people who feel this is crucial not only when you use immune-targeted therapies, but also in situations where we use signal transduction inhibitors, i.e. GIST with imatinib or erlotinib in non-small cell lung cancer, where in that setting, when you look at patients who are T-cell depleted, they don't respond as well as those patients with intact immune systems. So you may find, even in the setting of targeted therapies, you may find these immune therapies will have a greater benefit. I think our whole world of lung cancer in the next 5 years will be figuring out how to use these drugs, and I think it's going to be revolutionary.
Do you think Ipi has a future?
Ipi might. I mean, Ipi is being looked at now in squamous cell cancer. We've got a large phase 3 trial, which is just beginning in squamous cell cancer with chemotherapy, following up on our phase 2 trial. So I hold out some hope for ipilimumab. I think it's an important phase 3 trial. But ipilimumab hasn't been looked at as a single agent the way that PD-1 has. We have much more data on PD-1 as a single agent.
And when you give it with chemo, I guess you reported on that in ASCO a couple of years ago, are you usually using steroids for the chemo, getting back to the steroids?
So that's been one of my big complaints all along. It's been, we use so many steroids with Ipi, in lung cancer with chemotherapy, because you're giving carboplatin paclitaxel, is that do you dampen the immune response? You know, my melanoma colleagues would never use steroids with ipilimumab melanoma. In fact, they think that they're completely contraindicated. And Mario Schnall, who runs the melanoma group at Yale, won't give ipi if a patient's got brain mets is on steroids, because he says, Tom, it's like throwing it away, because they're not going to get the kind of benefit you need. So maybe the benefit will be even greater if one used gemcitabine or nab-paclitaxel or some agent that does not require the steroids. So I keep an open mind to that.
So to close out here, I actually want to introduce some issues slash cases we've heard about electronically by email, web posting, and social media slash Facebook and Twitter. First, a query about an older patient from a Dr. Philip Brooks. I have a 72-year-old man with non-small cell lung cancer with squamous differentiation who presented with metastatic disease to the lung and liver. After four cycles of carbopaclitaxel, he's had an excellent response with complete disappearance of disease in the neck and on CT of the liver. If this were non-squamous, I would employ a maintenance strategy, probably pemetrexed, but maybe erlotinib. What about maintenance in this patient? Jyothi?
This is sort of the platinum gemcitabine, the original maintenance, I guess. We have data that would suggest, from a progression-free survival endpoint, an older trial, the Broadwich trial, that shows gemcitabine continuations okay. We have the IFCT trial, the Phidias trial. I mean, there are options for maintenance for him, whether it's switch or continuation. I think in the question would become, how symptomatic is he? What's his quality of life after significant exposure to carboplatin and paclitaxel? My inclination for most patients with squamous cell tumors is to stop treatment and to give a bit of a break. But if he's had a stellar response and is tolerating the therapy, then it wouldn't be unreasonable. Finally, erlotinib has an FDA indication, albeit modest, but certainly erlotinib would be okay to do.
What do you think about erlotinib as maintenance, Tom, in the non-mutant kind of patient? And for that matter, second and third line therapy, a very common question we get.
I use it in second and third line therapy in non-mutated patients, but it's not with incredible enthusiasm, as I think you're seeing from Jyothi in her comments. Meaning, yes, it's indicated. Yes, it's an option. And I think there's not a person in this room who hasn't used it in second and third line lung cancer when you don't have any other options. I just don't think it's an incredible drug in those settings. I think it has some benefit, but I obviously would rather use it in mutants. But if you have someone who doesn't have a mutation, it is an option for second and third line therapy.
So finally, reflecting back on this case, we've had multiple queries recently, sort of a global concern about how these newer and increasingly meaningful assays like mutations in non-small cell actually are ordered and executed in the community, particularly compared to ER-HER2 and maybe Oncotype DX in breast cancer. Maggie?
Our pathologists don't reflexly order HER2 new for gastric cancer. They don't reflex the lung at all. We have to ask them for KRAS for colon. They don't automatically do that.
But of course, every breast specimen gets HER2 in ER, right.
Yep.
I would guess.
Yes. But think of how long that took.
Yeah,
to
that
get,
took a long time.
I mean, Neil, that that didn't happen right away. That took 10 years to get
more,
that.
You know, and of course, more. You know, there's also medical economics here. You know, you add on all these tests, they get expensive. Mm-hmm. And we have to think, I mean, it's great to think about doing all this stuff, but all of it costs money.
Well, the other thing that was brought up to me, maybe we'll just close on this, Tom. I was having a discussion with actually Heather Wakely, and she was talking about a case, and the question came up, should EGFR and ALK testing be done on adjuvant specimens? And I was saying, well, okay, yeah, maybe you're not going to use an adjuvant TKI, but wouldn't it be great, like with breast cancer, to know what the status is if they walk in, you know, short of breath and in deep trouble with metastatic disease in 6 months? And she was bringing up the issue of the fact that maybe a couple years from now, there's going to be other tests and you'll have shot your tissue and you won't have enough tissue left.
So I'd say two things about that. One is that all this worry about the cost of these tests is irrelevant because the cost is coming down so fast that the molecular tests will be no more expensive than immunoproxidase. In fact, they'll probably be cheaper than immunoproxidase.
No, that's good.
So the molecular testing will become easy. It'll become quicker. The point of using up tissues, though, that doesn't change. So that's actually not a bad point, that you use up tissue. And what you really care about is the mutational profile at the time you're going to be making your decision for treatment. So I don't think that's a bad argument from Heather's standpoint, depending upon how much specimen there is.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Rounds with the Investigators.